The following presentation was recorded during Teachers Week at Faith Builders. More information on Faith Builders events at fbep.org.
Welcome you to this workshop on teaching high school Bible. Now, I'm curious, how many of you, actually I should say secondary, it also includes junior high and high, how many of you have taught in junior high or high school a Bible class? Okay, how many of you are planning to this next year? Okay, I'd really like to hear from you for just a little bit, and I'd like for you to tell me what classes you will be teaching. In other words, what is the title of the course? What is the content, the basic content that is in it? Those of you who raised your hand on either one of those, could I hear some response from you? Jonathan, how about you?
That's only an emphasized story.
Okay.
At that age level for the New Testament.
Okay.
Give them those stories.
Someone else. Just keep them coming here a little bit.
Last year I taught the life of Christ and the history of the New Testament writings other than the gospel.
Okay, the epistles. Okay.
I'm teaching the Old Testament prophets.
The prophets. Okay.
Up in the book of Philippians, of course.
Okay, so the entire course on Philippians.
Philippians in English.
Okay.
This year, 100%. So the suggestion is using Doctrine of the Bible.
Okay. I just wanted to get a little idea from you what is being taught out there, and so perhaps give me a little bit of an idea of where to go with this. I'd like for us to begin with prayer, and then we'll jump right into it. Ivan, would you lead us, please?
Our Father in heaven, we thank you for this day. Thank you for the food that we've just eaten. Father, I pray you bless Steve in the class here as we look into the classroom. This upcoming year, Father, grant us the grace that we learn more of you. With each person here, the kids, brothers, and what they're doing.
Amen. I've said before that my college experience is what made a Mennonite out of me. Now, that's an oversimplification, but there are certain aspects of that that are true. And one part of that was a course that I took in my freshman year. It's called Biblical Hermeneutics. Now, this college was Columbia International University in Columbia, South Carolina. And biblical hermeneutics had the reputation of being one of those classes that, if you could, you'd avoid it. It was tough. And the students that went through it every night, they'd just come about midnight, they'd collapse in a heap and say, they'll never pass this course. In fact, it was the one course that the bookstore sold T-shirts that said, I survived hermeneutics. I think it was the only course in that school that had its own T-shirt. But anyway, it was tough. Now, as I took that course, and as I began to wrestle with the issues that it raised, got really excited about what can happen in a Bible class. And as I began to apply the types of things that were taught in there about how you should interpret the Scriptures, and apply that to the issues that I was wrestling with in terms of my own faith and belief system, time and time again, as I applied those principles, I kept saying, you know, what I've been taught is right. It's true. And it just completely revolutionized my own perspective of Bible study and what can happen in our Bible classes. And so what I want us to do today is think about some of the different... I want us to think through just a broad philosophy of teaching Bible in the secondary grades. Now, when we think of philosophy, we really need to answer three questions. We need to think about what are we going to teach, we're going to need to talk about why we're going to teach it, and we need to talk about how we're going to teach it. So that's where we're going to go. Now, I have a few things that I would like to share with you. I did not have as much time as I like to pull this together. In fact, there was just a little mix-up as to who was going to do this, and so I found out this morning that it was me. Now, I do have a few things to share on this, and I have taught Bible for a number of years, and this excites me immensely, what can happen here. And so I want to share this, but I also want to spend a fair amount of time with you bringing in the insights that you've had and your experience, either as a student in Bible classes or as a teacher, and the types of things that you're struggling with as you're looking forward to the next year or whenever in teaching the Bible. And so, first of all, I'm going to share some things in each of these three areas. Why do we teach it? What do we teach, and how do we teach? And I'd like for you to even give input as we move down through those things. But first of all, before we get into those three areas, I would like to just to look at two models of learning that I think will help us in our discussion of teaching Bible. The two models, one is the classical model of learning, often called the trivium, and the second one is one that comes from Ruth Beechick in her book, Biblical Psychology of Learning. And both of these models are worth spending some time looking at. But in the classical model of education, it is suggested that there are basically three kinds of learning. And they are, and I'll give them in order of complexity, grammar, dialectic, and rhetoric. The grammar has nothing to do with being able to correctly analyze a sentence. The grammar of a subject is the nuts and the bolts of a particular subject, whether it's Bible, history, science, or whatever we're looking at. The grammar of a subject are those facts that you have to have in order to be somewhat literate in a particular subject. So if our subject is American history, the grammar includes dates like 1776, it includes names like Daniel Boone, and so on. Okay, that is the grammar. The dialectic of a subject is another term we could possibly use here as synonymous, is the logic. That is the issues, the parts of a subject where there can be conflict, where there can be disagreement. It is the parts of a subject where you need to learn to understand. It is the conceptual part of a subject. The third type of learning has to do with rhetoric. And again, another word that we could use here for rhetoric would be communication. And so in the Middle Age model of learning, the classical model of learning, learning needs to encompass these three areas. And we'll look at that in more detail later. But for right now, I just wanted to introduce the model. In Biblical Psychology of Learning, Ruth Beechick suggests that there are three types of learning. And the learning, she gives some different names than what we have in the classical model. Knowledge is the one type of learning. Another type is concepts. And the third type she calls wisdom. Now she says, in order to do this learning, we also need to think about some other components. And the one component she mentions is parental love and discipline. The other one is called heart set. Now let me talk about this just briefly. We could actually spend hours and hours on both of these models, but I want to use these in thinking through how to teach secondary Bible. And so that's why I want to, just in an introduction, look at them quickly. You'll notice that knowledge corresponds very closely to the idea of the grammar of a subject. Again, this is the facts. These are those basic things that have to be known about any subject for you to be literate in that subject. But facts we know by themselves are not very meaningful. And so we need to place those facts together in significant ways to form concepts. But ultimately, the highest level of learning is wisdom. And I'm going to put another word here, that is creativity. Knowledge can lead to concepts. As we put the knowledge together, the concepts ultimately need to lead us to wisdom, to where we are communicating those concepts in creative and wise ways. Now, you'll notice there is a correspondence between this Beecik model and the classical model. The one thing that Beecik adds to our consideration is how we begin to move through this entire structure, and she suggests that everything begins right here with parental love and discipline. And that if this link is missing, it is going to be very difficult to take students through the process of moving from knowledge to concepts to wisdom. In addition, she says that the heart set is very significant in being able to get students to move up through here. Another word for heart set would be motivation. So when we're thinking about how to teach Bible, we need to think about each of these three areas. We also need to talk about these two areas. But for now, we'll let that go. And just two models. Any questions that you have about either one? I wish we could spend a lot of time here, but I'm not going to. But if you have some questions you'd like to bring up, I'll entertain those at this time. Okay. Let's move then to the question of why teach Bible. And I just want to open it up. Why do you teach Bible in your junior or senior high school? Tradition? Or is it important? And just because it's traditional doesn't mean it isn't important. Okay. So you're saying your ultimate goal is to have your students involved relationally with someone, and Bible is the method. Okay, Bible class is a method. Okay, someone else. Why do you teach Bible? What is your vision for getting in the classroom? What do you want to accomplish? What do you want to see happen because of it? Okay. Flesh that out for us a little bit. We want them to be wise. Flesh that out a little bit. What is it we're talking about?
Help them serve God. Really understand what it means to be a Christian.
You want to create people that are servants of God. Okay, someone else. How do you know they're doing that? I want us to put some flesh on this. Okay, so another reason for teaching Bible is to pass on the kind of life and energy that God has placed in you and actually duplicate that in your students, okay? It's a great vision. Someone else. Okay, you want to make world changers, people that are actually not just living it, but are actually spreading it. So in other words, doing what you're trying to do. Okay, someone else. I suspect teaching Bible should be the one class we get more excited about than any other that we have. I love teaching math. I love teaching science. Actually, I enjoy teaching just about everything. But you know, it is in Bible class where the curriculum is just designed to deal with the significant aspects of life. To really get down and deal on the level where all of us live, if we let it. But so often, Bible class never goes there. So often, Bible class still just deals in the level of knowledge, in the level of grammar, and never, never gets to the level where we're actually creating and inspiring world changers, writers, teachers, artists, musicians that are full of God and are going to communicate that in creative ways, changing a world. But that's what we need to do in our classes. That needs to be our overriding vision. Now, I want us, though, to take this thing apart just a little bit, because it's easy to live on that level to think about that. Boy, yeah, I want my... But we need to break that down into manageable categories. And so I'd like for us to consider for just a little bit why we should teach the grammar of Bible, why we should teach the dialectic of Bible, and then why we should teach the rhetoric. Now, everything we've said so far is right here. This is where we want to go. This is what we get excited about. But I'm going to suggest we better understand what the place of this is if we're going to go here. And so I'd like for us to consider why grammar, why dialectic, and then we'll reiterate what we've already said about the rhetoric. Now, in order for this to make a certain amount of sense, you do need to have in mind what each of these categories is talking about. And so if I could, just once again, go back over them. The grammar has to do with the facts of the subject. So if we're talking about the Old Testament, the facts of our subject includes the names of the books of the Bible, includes the people, the names of the people and who they were and what they did in the Old Testament. It includes an understanding of the geography, where Canaan is in the world, where Jerusalem is in relationship to Bethlehem. These are all parts of the grammar. Okay, does that make sense? That's significant. The dialectic, the logic has to do with the in the subject. And there are many, many issues in our that we need to go and look at. And so questions like, how did the earth get here? Did God really create it, or was there some other way? Maybe universal. Is it wrong? That's the issues. And then the third area, the idea of rhetoric, being once you have the nuts and bolts of a subject, once you understand something of the issues and have wrestled with the issues and begin to come to conclusions and begin to have those voila experiences, oh, yeah, I see it. Oh, yeah. That's when you're operating down here. And that's where we want to move people to, but it takes this to get there. Now, one other thing I might mention right here, and that is that educators have observed that there's a certain developmental growth through these three areas. Have you noticed that students in elementary classrooms, grades 1 to 3, 4, 5, 6, that they love working on this level? They'll memorize and they like to do little chants and did it. That's all in the grammar area. Okay, this is where a younger person, grades 1 to 6, is hardwired for memory. Now, have you also noticed when students get into junior high that they like to start challenging everything? Is that really right? They love to debate. They will bring up, if they can find any flaws in your teaching, they'll bring it up. They're working on the dialectic stage. They're developmentally ready for that. And by the time students are in 10th, 11th, 12th grade, if they have proper background in these two areas, they're ready to communicate. They're ready to share. They've got things that they want to put down on paper and communicate in significant ways. Now, and so that's something you need to think about. If you're teaching in the upper grades, hopefully your classes can focus here. However, if this has never been done well, you'll need to go here. I've noticed this saying like in American history classes. And by the way, this is an aside, but modern education has devalued this significantly, particularly for the lower grades. And they say, what you need to do is get them to be thinking creatively. You need to get them to working with issues and so on. And students can't do that if they don't have the grammar. So we've got to give them the nuts and bolts of the subject before we can expect them to be operating on this level. Now, every subject that you teach, I don't care whether it's first grade or whether it's college level, needs to include all three of these components if it's going to be a well-rounded, balanced course. But you may emphasize one or the other more depending on the nature of the course and the level of student that's in it. I would suggest that your senior, your 11th and 12th graders, their courses need to be focusing in right here. They have the grammar, a lot of it in place. They need to be focusing on this. Your junior hires need to be focusing here. Now, maybe you have a question at this point. Do you want to? Or a comment? Okay, then why? Why teach grammar? We've already looked at this just a little bit, but in a nutshell, we need to teach the grammar of a subject because it is the grammar. We do this in order to provide the raw material for God to work in a person's experience. You see, God works with knowledge. He does not work in a vacuum. And so there needs to be some fundamental knowledge, some fundamental truth there in order to go to your conceptual and communicative knowledge. If we have an environment that is rich in grammar, rich in the details of a subject, it will spawn thinking in these two levels. It will happen. If you make it rich down here, you will spawn thinking on these two levels. And so it is the bedrock. That's why we teach grammar, because you have to have that in order for you to be able to do the logical and rhetorical types of thinking. Now, there's a book that has nothing to do with teaching Bible. It's called Cultural Literacy by E.D. Hirsch. And in this particular book, Hirsch develops the idea that one of the major failures of modern education is that we have failed to give students the raw materials of their subjects in the elementary grades. And he documents this, and what his foundation based in Charlottesville, Virginia has done is they have pulled together the core knowledge, the grammar of the basic subjects you teach in school, literature and math and so on. They pulled that together and they say this is the content that students have to have in their first six grades if they're going to be able to do this as they move on up through. And so there's a certain resurgence both in classical education and in core knowledge schools to emphasize more the grammar. And I would suggest that you give some serious consideration to that in your schools, not just in your Bible program, but in all the programs. We've been experimenting with that. We're the school that I come from in Barnwell, South Carolina, and just had some wonderful dividends from that. Now, just to make this point of why it is so important for us to develop the grammar. You see, it's easy for us as we're thinking about significant classes, significant teaching that changes lives, it's easy for us to say, well, this is not where you want to go. Where you want them to go is struggling with the issues. You know, those existential issues that we all struggle with. And so this is where you want to go. But the difficulty is that we have no methods that ensure that we can create this in students. There are no ways. In fact, if you look at the fads in educational circles, and every 10 years we move through different fads, cooperative learning fads, and just one thing to the other, and you'll watch that change, and what it is, it's attempts to figure out how you really teach on this level, and basically we just keep going around and around, and we're not sure quite how to do it. We have some ways that seem to work on some occasions, but here's where we can teach here. But the point is, if we do our job well here, it will develop this. Now, I'm not saying you shouldn't teach here. You need to give opportunities for this to develop. But think about a person, let's say, that starts taking an interest in professional baseball. So what does he do? He begins to read the papers, and he begins to, by the way, I'm not advocating this. It's an illustration. he begins to look at the different players that make up the teams, and he starts memorizing it. You ask him who the pitcher is, and he can tell you. You ask him who the starting lineup is, he can tell you that. Ask him for statistics, he can give you all that. Now, what's he done? He's memorizing the grammar of the subject. Now, I'll bet you that no one has sat down with him and said, let me explain to you how to do some critical thinking about baseball. Let me explain to you some of the issues. But if you, no one has done that, but if you go up to him and say, you know, so-and-so is a lousy player, or such-and-such a play, and or such-and-such a call, and such-and-such a game was a poor call, they will have an opinion. Now, where did they get that? Did someone teach them to have an opinion? It developed because they had a grammar-rich education. And Hirsch, in this book, through a variety of studies, shows that if you're rich in the grammar, it is going to inevitably lead people into these areas of thinking. And so let's not discount the importance of teaching the grammar. Yes?
Is that where,
if they have a... Exactly. If they have that background, they are able then to be able to give facts and figures. But have you ever tried to get students to have an opinion on something where they have absolutely no data for? And then we get upset with them, or we struggle with them and say, why can't you come up with some good thoughts? We have to, first of all, give them the material. Now, I'm not saying give it to them in cold, boring, dry ways. We'll get to that in a moment. I'm saying we've got to give them the material. And let's not buy into some of these contemporary thinking that memorization and drill and that kind of stuff is bad. It's not. It's essential. So that's why we teach the grammar. Why do we teach the dialectic, the logic? We teach that, and by the way, this is, if the grammar is knowledge, the dialectic is understood knowledge. Now, it is possible. It is possible for someone to have a lot of facts, but not understand those facts. And so we need to provide a context for our students to move from the knowledge to understood knowledge. And so our reason that we teach on this level is to provide a context wherein students can come to understand truth. First of all, we teach them the truths, and then we give them a context in order to where they can come to understand. Someone has said that it's not so much how much you've been through the Bible, but how much the Bible has been through you. See, that's what it's talking about. You going through the Bible is learning the grammar. But now the real test of it is how much has that grammar impacted your life? And how much has it changed your way of thinking? So that's why we need to live on this level. Unless the truth of Scripture gets beyond the cognitive, beyond the grammar, beyond the knowledge level, it is not going to have any kind of eternal impact. So we must give some attention to living here with our students. Why teach rhetoric? Because not only do we want students to know truth, grammar, not only do we want them to understand truth, the dialectic, we also want them to live truth. And so we go here, we teach on this level in order to equip students to live. We want to be instrumental in shaping a generation of people that make a significant difference for the kingdom. And that's what can happen in our Bible classes. That's why we teach. Okay, questions, comments here. Yes.
Modern, the fact that absolutes have been so clearly done away with, that once you move into those realms, what do they really have to work with?
Exactly. They've lost the battle right back here to begin with. There is no grammar that's absolute anymore. And so, yes, that is another tremendous fault of modern educational systems. But I would also suggest, too, that part of this struggle of moving from one type of learning to another is an attempt to operate on this level. But that it's, we can't find a way that works for everybody. In fact, this is something we can create an environment, we can create a context. But a method is very difficult to actually come up with that ensures that all of our students are going to actually have those experiences where the lights come on. But if we create the environment, it will often happen. Now, maybe that's not an important enough distinction, but I'm suggesting to you that right back here, if we do our job well here, that those experiences are going to be somewhat innate. In other words, I think God has wired us to operate on these levels if we have the content to work with. That is, now there's a method of going here. And I think you're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, you see, it's very easy for us, and I'll talk about this a little bit more later, but it's very easy for us to mistake concepts, opinions, and statements of conceptual truth with the grammar of a subject. And we tend to teach these things as if they were grammar. Now, follow me on that, because it's an important distinction. Is it true that Jesus Christ is God? That is a truth. I would suggest to you that that is a truth, though, that operates more in this level than it does back here. And if we take that statement and teach it only as grammar, we are going to cripple our students' development. See, that's a statement of concept. It's a statement that needs to be wrestled with. It's a statement that needs to be examined. Okay? And it's very easy for us as teachers to take all the material up in here, and we want to communicate this. We want the students to get it, so we stick it back here on this stage, and we completely abort the entire process for getting to where they can get to those same conclusions. Yes?
So, practically speaking, you're saying that we'd say,
I think they need to wrestle. They need to wrestle with that issue because it does not come naturally in our thinking. And if a student has never wrestled with it in your classroom, they're going to wrestle with it out there when a skeptic gets a hold of them. But now, yes, a statement of fact, Matthew records the genealogy of Jesus. That's factual information. Okay, and we can present, that's grammar. And I could even suggest, maybe in a classroom, that, hey, Jesus Christ is the Son of God, but hey, let's look at some of the issues surrounding that. And so we're kicking it up the step a little bit. We're going from grammar, but we're starting to push it into the conceptual learning. Okay, someone else want to clarify some of this in your mind? Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what we were
drilled. Okay. That's right. And it's not just that you throw it out as what do you think about it, but that you say, hey, look, here's the body of facts that we have so that we can make intelligent, rational conclusions. It's not just, hey, in a vacuum, I think this or I think that.
Mm-hmm. And from that comes a logical conclusion, which might also be factual.
Exactly.
That Jesus is the Son of God, but since it's somewhat derived from this set of facts, in other words, make it more subjective. We don't want to do that. Christ has died is also factual. You know what I'm saying?
It is factual, but it is the type of fact that if you do not wrestle with it, it may not seem factual. And depending on the environment that you're in, you could come to exactly the opposite conclusion. And so, yes, I'm saying that I think a number of these issues must be wrestled with by your students. rather than you presenting all this material as just fact, as grammar of the subject, you begin to isolate the things that are clearly accepted by a wide body of people. This is the nuts and bolts of the subject. But now, here's where the issues lie. Now, I would also suggest that it does not hurt at all to teach that Jesus Christ is the Son of God in the elementary as a fact. But somewhere along the line, I would suggest that needs to be struggled with. Yes, if we're dealing with the Civil War, okay, our grammar is going to be the names of the generals, the statistics, the size of the armies, the different battles, and so on. This is going to be, why did the South lose? Now, I could come up with a set of facts to give you, and that's often the way we teach the history of the Civil War. These are the reasons the South lost. These are the reasons the North won. But what are we doing? We are giving this as grammar. We're giving them a list of five things as to the reasons why they lost, the reasons why they won. Whereas we need to be getting away from that as we move up through, as the older a student gets, and where they're spending more time right here. Now, if you are well versed in the grammar of the subject of the Civil War, you're going to be able to start making these connections yourself. You're going to be able to see how the geography played into this, how some of the international relations played into this, and so on. How some of the numbers of people, numbers of men in the military played into this. And you can say, you know, I bet this was a reason. And so that's what I'm saying, is that we begin to think about the parts of our subjects that need to be put onto a higher level, and don't abort the process. But as Christians, we want to abort the process, because we want them to think like we think. And so we keep everything right down here. And it's just a whole bunch of output. I'm just giving you, rather than you begin to process these things and come to the connections yourself. Okay? Someone else.
Stick my neck out here. If you cut off, it would all be grammar, and we'd never get into the rhetoric, never discussion. And then when things are discussed, you'd all... not communicate on the grammar level, but you would have never in Bible or any other class.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying that that's not good, or
going to an eighth grade tenth or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cutting it off.
And that's unfortunate. And of so many of our students never do get there. And then we wonder why they struggle so much when they're confronted by people who are insisting that they think through the issues, but this time the climate, the context, the environment encourages them to completely different answers. Yes. Mm-hmm. There is some developmental characteristics of children. It seems like they begin to make the transition, but it obviously clearly depends on the individual. We're talking averages now. And I feel like it's generally counterproductive. They're generally not ready for it developmentally to do that. Okay, let's move then to consideration of what do we teach. And I'd like for us to go back through these three categories just quickly again. What do we teach? We teach facts. We teach issues, and we teach conclusions. That's what this stage is going to do for us. We want them not to just let them hanging out there with these issues and not ever coming to answers, but we want to encourage them to come to their own answers, and then what are the implications of those answers for the way you live your life, and how are you going to communicate that to our world? Okay, so just in a nutshell, facts, issues, conclusions. But now, what about the subject matter, the content? This would apply to whatever. One of the things that we did at our school was to go to the ministry and sit down with them at the church there and say, what do you want the school to be doing in terms of Bible instruction? Now, the answers that we got are perhaps a little unusual. Basically, what they told us was that in the elementary grades, they did not... They didn't care if we didn't have a Bible curriculum. And that the one, as we talked about in some of the things that the school does well, the things that the church does well, and the family does well, we came to the conclusion that the school should be involved in intensive Bible memory. And so that's one thing we do starting at grade one. And we also will have just an early morning exercise where we'll sing and so on, and maybe do some short discussions or and so on in the elementary grades. But we do not have Bible there. That was the answer that came in working through all this. In the upper grades, the answer was that still, we want the home and the Sunday school to be the primary teacher of Bible, but we want the school to teach some things that will never happen in the Sunday schools. And so what were those things? For us, it was Old Testament, New Testament survey. And those are going to be some great courses that you'll never have in a Sunday school setting. Something to give that big picture, where you can see the whole, everything that happens in the Old Testament in context with everything else. The survey, good survey classes, Old Testament, New Testament. And one thing I would mention there is, some of you mentioned a life of Christ. A life of Christ using a harmony of the Gospels can be so illuminating. Again, where you're seeing the events in chronological order, how they fit, kind of like a survey class. I would also suggest that as you move, if this is junior high and high school that you're teaching in, and if you have any say-so whatsoever in terms of what you put, what is taught, a couple courses I would suggest to you. One is a good course on Bible study methods, including interpretation. Remember, that's the course that I began by talking about, that it just really revolutionized my whole approach to Scriptures. If you can give students a vision for what can happen as they study the Scriptures, not just in a devotional context, but in a more of a serious scholarly approach, it's so worthwhile. But not only do you give them a vision for it, you give them the tools so they know how to use the concordances and Bible study tools and how they can interpret passages, prophetic passages, how they can interpret difficult passages, like 1 Corinthians 11 and so on. Giving them the tools to be able to do that. Ethics, it's a good course, where you look at the issues of morality. What about euthanasia? What about swearing in court and so on and so on and so on. Apologetics. Giving your students or helping them to think through the issues of why the Scriptures are the Word of God, why they are inerrant, why creation is worthy of thinking people. Apologetics. A worldviews class where you develop a Christian worldview and you look at the alternatives. And maybe this could even include kind of a introduction to philosophy. The different philosophies of life and what a Christian philosophy is. Again, this is all operating here on these levels. I'm not saying where you just batch feed them a philosophy, but where you help them to develop their own statement of faith. Now you say, this is risky. You're absolutely right. But it's risky not. I think that's all that I'll say. Of course, book studies would be one other category. So some survey classes, some issues classes, and then book studies would be things to consider as well. At our school, the scope and sequence, we had a half a year in 7th through 12th grade, and we rotated in junior high, we rotated Old Testament, New Testament survey, and Bible study methods. In the high school, the 10th, 11th, 12th, we rotated an ethics, apologetics, and worldviews. Okay, any thoughts or questions here on what types of courses should be taught in Bible, secondary Bible? A lot of you may not have any flexibility here. You're told what course to teach, and if that's the case, that makes it all the easier. But if you ever have some input into the types of things that should be taught, that's why I suggested some of these. Yes. Okay. Good question. Maybe someone has some input here that's in a similar situation. Okay. And you can take something like that and actually teach it in a classroom. Now, when we get to methods, you can see this has to happen in group context. I really don't know any other way of creating environment for this to take place. Some students will do it on their own, but most will not. Most need a little encouragement to start wrestling with the issues, because that's work. And that's why I think it is significant that you do it in the group setting. Someone else have some help here. I'll tell you where I'd start. I'd start with Bible study methods. Now, if it's seventh grade, if it's coming right out, I'd start very, very on an elementary level. Okay? But actually getting them doing their own Bible study is a tremendous skill. And that's the one thing you want to accomplish, if nothing else. And then I would go to a survey. Yes. Okay. Yeah, I'll tell you, I have seen a variety of courses, and I don't like any of them. And it's not because they're not necessarily good. It's that the Bible course, I think, needs to fit you somewhat. I do have a couple resources to suggest to you that can be useful in putting together your own, say, survey course. One extremely helpful is called Talk Through the Bible by Bruce Wilkinson. And what he has done is pulled the grammar of the Bible together for you. It's right here. And so both Old Testament and New Testament survey courses that I teach, a lot of the essential core knowledge, irreducible minimum of material, comes right out of here. This is extremely useful. Now, another thing that I believe in very strongly in terms of Bible teaching, and not in other subjects, but in Bible teaching, is the use of worksheets to get students actually into this, the textbook for your course. And where they have to come in here and find the information. Okay, and so between those, yeah, I'll talk about this a little bit more on the how to teach, but I really think you're going to be a lot happier if you put together your own course in Bible. Yeah, worksheets, yes. See, by the way, this right here, a lot of this can be done by the students. This is where individualized education can shine, by the way. And by the way, when you try to do individualized education down here, it's tough. It's frustration for teachers and for students. And just as a CLE really does try to operate here, and I grant them kudos for doing that. BCE, ACE tends to operate up here. And my experience has been those people who use the curriculums that these people up here are less satisfied with the results, but much happier with how it actually works on a day-to-day basis. In other words, it's manageable. These people are happier with the results and pull their hair out working it. Which suggests to me that perhaps the methodology should be questioned a tad. Oh, is that a heretical statement? Someone, yes. Okay. Okay. Well, we didn't need that, did we? Thank you. I appreciate that. Yes.
Just a suggestion as far as curriculum. I know they probably do more of a factual.
You haven't seen it, and so you. Yeah, oh, you have seen it. Oh, you have thought.
Oh, just section 7.
Okay.
I taught at PGH this year. I used the latches last year.
And it's worked very well for you.
Yeah, you should sort of want to broaden out.
Okay.
You're not doing a survey, not the same one at grammar level. But,
okay. Okay, someone else. I don't know that I've, well, maybe when I get to the other section, I'll deal with this a little more adequately, and then we can come back with further questions along that line. Because I know this is where you're living, and so I want to spend some time and be practical there. How to teach. We've looked at why we should teach. We've looked at a little bit of what we should teach. Now let's talk about methods. I want you to tell me what methods have worked for you, either as a student or as a teacher. Think about Bible classes that really did something for you. What were the methods used that worked? Let's understand him. He's not saying he didn't learn. He's just saying he doesn't have memories of it. But that's significant. And I'll tell you, my experience is almost identical. I went to public school for 8 grades. And the 9th grade, I started in individualized. And I can recollect one academic memory from when I graduated with individualized. And then I did a lot of the coursework, lots of it. I have one academic memory. That was the 3rd book in the algebra series. I remember it was a lot of word problems. And other than that, I cannot come up with an academic memory. Oh, I have memories of those years, but they were not academic. And I think that's sad. I can go through grades 1 through 8. Grade 1 was in a Christian school in Virginia. But 2 through 8 was public, and I can give you academic memories right after the other for all 8 of those grades. Things that we did together in class, discussions we had, so on and so forth. Now, that was an aside, wasn't it? But thank you. So what are you saying? You're giving the negative.
I'm along with that. One thing that taught me, I had a book, and I used that as an outline to use my ideas of what to use.
Okay.
And that seemed to
work. Good take. I would suggest, I want to get back to my question, but I have noticed in the courses that I've taken, the ones that have really, really done something for me are the ones where the teacher knows their subject to the point where they can write their own curriculum. And it would be wonderful if all of us could write our own curriculums for every subject we teach. That is totally irrational. But I would suggest that Bible maybe is the one area where you should stretch yourself to do it. That's the one area where most of us tend to have more knowledge than the other areas. Okay? So that might even inspire you to do some work in curriculum development. And some others. Classes that you remembered, what was effective about them? What methods were used?
I forget which. Anyways, there were sentences with blanks in it. It was just the thing that excited me the most. I found the book that the teacher was looking at to get that question. I had to go add 5 books.
So the excitement of discovery. Okay. That's actually operating here on his level, isn't it? It's you starting to wrestle with what is important in life, what is important to study. And let me tell you, this is where your classrooms can start coming alive. And Bible class can take on a tremendous meaning if you're willing to go there. But it's also dangerous. I have probably gotten more criticism in our school for the things that we've talked about in Bible class than any other. And it's not that I'm not conservative. It's not that I'm not orthodox. It's just that I wouldn't always give the answer right away. And that is threatening. But anyway, let's camp here just a little bit longer. What has worked in your Bible classes? I don't hear a great outpouring of just significant experiences. Now, think about yourself as a student. What has really gripped you? Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. And by the way, that's an important distinction. Quizzes really are effective ways to measure grammar. It's much more difficult to use quizzes to measure the other two levels of learning. I suggest that you should, there's other ways to measure them very effectively, but tests and quizzes probably are not the best. But anyway, that's an aside, okay? And so there was, you're saying it was some of that independent work that you had to do that made it meaningful for you. Okay? And just independent work can be good. It can be meaningful. Someone else.
The discussion in high school.
Okay.
I think the lecture in high school is more meaningful than a lot of your
work. And yet, they can do their book work. They can do their book work on their own. That can be done reasonably well independently. Okay? Someone else have something they want to say here? Yes. Okay. What I'd like to do is talk about each of these three levels of learning and give some ideas, some methods for teaching each one. So we'll start with the grammar. In order to teach the grammar, first of all, you have to figure out what it is. And this is not as easy as it may seem. But in other words, you must sit down and say, what is it in this course that my students must know forwards and backwards? What is it in this subject, Old Testament survey, the book of Romans, what is it that is, if they're going to be literate in this particular area, they have to know these particular facts? Now, this is going to vary with the person. What is it? What are the 10 dates in American history that you have to know in order to understand something of American history? What are the 30 most significant people that everybody has to have something in their psyche about in order to feel like that they are literate in American history? And so on. That's what you have to go and find. That's finding the irreducible minimum, the grammar of a subject. And then you need to stick that grammar into instructional objectives. Now, you'll notice on the one handout that I gave you, the syllabus, this, by the way, is a syllabus that I used for the course I taught this summer here at Faith Builders. So this was not a high school course. It's actually higher than that. It's tougher than that. But you'll notice down under requirements and standards, well, first of all, under objectives, the student will be able to recall the significant content and organization of each Old Testament book. See, that is some of this grammar, some of this core knowledge that I want them to be able to know and be able to regurgitate. This is just cold, hard facts. There's nothing fun here necessarily. I want them to be able to describe the historical and geographic context for each Old Testament book. This is not much, but when you think the book of Exodus, where does the book of Exodus occur? That's a geographic context. It's not that you have to know a whole lot of things, but you need to know something, okay? And so for each of the books in the Old Testament, I want the students to be able, that's core knowledge for me. That's grammar that's essential. And so that's, you have to know what grammar you want. You write it into your syllabus as instructional objectives. This is what the student is going to be learning. These are the 15 dates, the 25 people, and so on. And then you drill, and there's a word we don't like, but you drill that. You drill that core knowledge. In fact, if you can, you get all that stuff out of the way in the first 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks of school. And then you just repeat it and drill it, and for the rest of the year, you continue to test it. Because that's what you want to lock in. Now, just because I said drill does not mean that this has to be dead. There's lots of really interesting ways to drill. Now, one of my objectives for an Old Testament class in high school is to be able to understand the major dates and the major events and the major people, about 30, 40, 50 of them, in order that they come in scriptures. And so one of the ways we do that is through what we call a walkthrough. And this is similar to what, if you've been to an Old Testament walk through the Bible seminar put on by Walk Through the Bible Ministries, you'll know a little bit of how this goes. But I have a first page of one that that I use in a high school class. I also used it this summer just as a kind of a model. But you'll notice you're just walking through in the left-hand column, you're walking through the major events in the order that they come, some of the major concepts, and you say them in order as well as demonstrate them. Now, Ivan, do you want to... Ivan was in my Old Testament class this summer, and so I thought maybe he'd want to come up and demonstrate. Actually, I'll just walk through the first part here. Notice it just has different phrases, and for each phrase, there is some kind of motion. So it's, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Day one, light. Day two, sky, water. Day three, dry ground, plants, and so on. And, boy, you can have a lot of fun with this. And you just, every morning for 3-4 minutes, you go through that. And what you are doing is you're locking in the chronology. If you look down through here, there's significant dates put in here. This can be done not just in Bible. It can be done in any kind of history course that you would have. So this is one way to just lock grammar in, but in a fun way. Another thing that's important for me in any kind of historical class, whether it's Old Testament survey, New Testament survey, or even the books, is the geographic setting. You must always tie material to the historic and geographic context. You have to do that in order to create understanding. And so I always want students to be able to think. When they hear a place, they need to get mental pictures where this is working at. And so we spend a lot of time getting in our minds the map of Canaan and the map of the Middle East. Again, this is just raw grammar. Basically, the students get to the point where they can draw those maps memory and put the places on. It's not where they can just fill in the place. They know those maps, backwards, forwards. Now, how can you liven that up? One of the things we do is we have a contest. After they have learned the map, they've learned the places, learned the bodies of water, and so they know where the Mediterranean is and the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea and the Jordan River, all this stuff, then it's okay. You're in groups of 3 or 4. What we're going to do is go outside. We have a lot of sand in South Carolina, and you're going to each get a patch of sand, and you need to make a map out there. You can plan it. They give them about 2 or 3 weeks to plan how they're going to do it. So in the recess time, it's when they're planning. And they'll go out there in that sand and model the mountain ranges. They have to make signs for each of the cities and stick them in and so on. And then we take the elementary students out there and see, and the elementary students grade them, vote for which ones they like the best. And so it's just a fun way to once again lock in this grammar. That's all it is. We're just looking at the facts. But there are ways to make the grammar interesting. Now, here's a problem. It's easy for us to have so much grammar, and that's all we get done. And it's just grammar, 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 and people die with that kind of administration. And that's why it's important that you come up with the core. This is what you have to know. And let me tell you, we're going to learn it in 3 weeks, and we're going to have fun for the rest of the year. You're going to learn it in those 3 weeks, and you're going to know it at the end of 6 weeks, at the end of 9 weeks, at the end of 18 weeks, at the end of 24 weeks, you're going to just be tested on it over and over again. They get hundreds every time, and they love it because they're making hundreds, they're succeeding. And it's a lot of stuff. But the thing is, you keep doing that because you want to lock that grammar in. And you keep giving more and more time in between when you keep testing them. So, till the end, if you go ahead and test them 6 or 7 times on this, till the end, this stuff, they know. And you come to them several years later, and they can still regurgitate this stuff. Now, is that where we're headed? No. That's not the end of this. But if you have given students this, then they can actually start giving back in significant ways later. But you got to give them some content to work with. Okay? So, how do you teach? You drill and test grammar in creative ways. Just some other ideas here. Sometimes I'll take the students, like if it's a class of 10 or 12, and we'll actually arrange the chairs in a map of Canaan. And so a couple of you would be like, this might be the Jordan River over here, and one of you would be the Sea of Galilee, and one would be the Dead Sea. And then we'd go through, okay, the book of Exodus, you got to raise your hand if it happened there. And so on. And so you kind of get the flavor of the geography, just look at them. Timelines. We said geographic context is significant. You also need to know the historical context. Timelines, you just live with timelines. They need to be able to do timelines in their sleep. Great way to do a quiz. String up a clothesline and have all your different events on the postcards and with a clothespin attached to them. And then here's where the student has to come up and stick their event in the proper time slots. So if you have 30, 40 events, you can, you know, they'll have to be able to stick them in between the right things. Also, it's good when you're reviewing grammar if you can, just like we've done here with this map, making a map in the ground, if you can actually get tangible with some of these things. One of the things, that we do in Old Testament to make the idea of Passover tangible is we actually go through one. We get together and we have a Passover together, just as it would have been celebrated traditionally. And so there's lots of ways that you can do grammar in ways that don't kill. My plea is don't neglect the grammar. That's my plea. Because in a lot of modern thought, we're getting away from that. Okay. Any questions here on how to teach that? Have I communicated anything so far? Questions, comments? Memorization is not a bad word. And your students will thank you if you really get them to memorize and memorize well. They will come back years later and thank you. Okay, how then do you teach the dialectic? One of my favorite Bible teachers is Howard Hendricks. And Hendricks tells about when he was a young man, he gave a lecture at a place in Texas. And he said, he was up lecturing and he said, you know, teachers, he said, it's like the old adage, when you're dealing with students, You can take a horse to water, but you can't make him drink. He said, after he was done, he said, an old-timer, a cowboy, comes up to him and says, Sonny, you're wrong. I said, what you mean? He said, well, that thing about taking a horse to water, you can't make him drink. He said, you can feed him salt. And that's exactly what we need to be doing in this area of our teaching. How do you teach the dialectic? You feed him salt. In other words, you create a hunger for them to want to know the answers to the issues. You raise, and the only way to do that is to raise the issues in ways that make them a little uncomfortable. For example, if I just come in here and I say, okay, we're going to talk today about creation, it'll kill. If I even say, how do you know that the world... How do we know that the world was created by God? Okay, what are answers you going to get? Yeah, God tells us in the Bible. See, what you got to do, if you want to go that route, you just say, he says that's right. Why do you believe Genesis 1:1? And then all of a sudden they start looking at you funny. Well, it's the Bible. But who says the Bible's right? Well, we've always been told that. Who's told you that? My parents. Here's where it gets sticky. Who says they're right? And then you got them. And they start getting thirsty. Hey, you know, well, yeah. How do I know? Now, you got to be careful with that one. But I'm saying this is what you have to do. If all you're going to do is regurgitate the old answers, don't go here. It's going to kill. If you're willing to open it up, you see, I think it's safe to go there. I think it's safe to ask the questions about how do you know your parents are right, because there are very good answers to those questions. But when you're willing to go there, all of a sudden, boy, the interest level picks up. Okay? So when you begin your Bible classes, you begin with a hook. You have to hook them. Now, how are you going to do that? Let's go back to our old issue of the deity of Jesus. Now, one of the wonderful ways to kill a class is to come and say, today, class, we are going to be talking about the doctrine of Jesus Christ. That word you just kind of have to avoid because we have this negative connotation about doctrine. Doctrine is a great word. But when people think doctrine, they think boring. And one of the things we don't want to do is bore people with the Scriptures. And so, instead of saying, we're going to be talking about the doctrine of Jesus Christ, and maybe even looking at whether the deity of Christ, you begin by saying, hey, you know the other day, I was reclining in my easy chair, enjoying a book, knock on the door. Go to the door, and guess what? Two people standing there, well-dressed. Yeah, Jehovah's Witnesses. Well, I really wasn't in the mood, but I felt like I should go out and initiate a conversation. So I went out, and we began to talk. And we began to talk. Very soon, they began to share what they believed, and I started telling what I believed. And very soon, those people told me that I was putting my faith in someone other than the true God. I said, oh, really? My faith is in Jesus Christ. They said, he's not God. Now, were they right or not? That's what we're going to look at today. And then you begin to talk about the deity of Jesus Christ. Okay, so you start with a hook. Also, in teaching the dialectic, it is vitally important that you learn where your students are living. What are the issues that really grip them? What are the questions that they're facing? You see, you probably want to go into class with your questions. You have to go into class with their questions. If you're going to do well in the dialectic area of teaching, you need to learn to ask those. A teacher of mine at Columbia walked into his office one day. I hadn't spoken a word to him in a personal way until this point. I walk into his office. I think some of you have probably heard me tell this, but walk into his office and he looks up and he says, Brubaker, you're a Mennonite, aren't you? I said, yes, sir. He says, how does it feel to live in a country where your freedom has been bought with my blood? Now, he had me in the dialectic immediately. Why? I didn't give a very good answer. And I stumbled around a little bit, said a few things. And then he changes the subject on me. And he says, well, what do you think of Bible smuggling? Coincidentally, I had been reading Brother Andrew not too awful long before and was just impressed. Impressed with some of the stories he told. Let me back up one step. He said, what do you do? Before that, he had asked me, he says, what do you do with these people, you know, that go to war, these Christian people that go to war, and you know how their lives have been protected by having a New Testament in their pocket and so on? He says, what do you, and I said, well, you know, hey, that's just a story. He said, what do you think of Bible smuggling? Completely unrelated, caught me completely off guard. And I said, well, you know, listen to the stories of Brother Andrew. It's kind of impressive how the Lord walked him through some of these really difficult situations. And you see, he had me. He had me. He said, in that basis, you have to be for war too. And I began to learn a little something about what it means to think. And then he said, Steve, I'm not trying to give you a rough time. But he said, I want you, if you're going to believe in non-resistance, I want you to do it from a thoughtful perspective. He said, the worst papers I get at this school are from people who are trying to defend war from a Christian perspective. And he said, so you've got a position that's defensible. But he said, do it rationally, do it thoughtfully. We need to hear that. It's easy for us just to take an opinion of, I'm not going to do this or I'm going to do that. Why? I'm not really sure. Or, this is the way my parents taught me. Frankly, I think our parents were right on that one and on many others, but I have to understand why they're right. If I am going to be able to operate on this level and actually minister to other people. And so let's learn to ask significant questions. This is the technique on how to teach dialectic. There's nothing else I can tell you. How do you do it? You ask significant questions. Now, how do you learn to ask significant questions? This is not easy. Lots of people do not ask significant questions. They ask grammar-based questions. We need to learn to ask the significant ones. Okay? We need to be sure that we're not just asking grammar-based, that we're moving up through the ladder. In fact, let me just give you a quick ladder that you may want to think about. I'm not sure what happened to my chalk here. Well, anyway, I'll just tell you. Oh, okay.
Very good.
On the bottom of the ladder, of course, would be the facts. When you're asking questions, it's okay to ask some fact-based questions, but you don't stay there. You begin to ask questions that show the relationship between the facts, and then, of course, we call the concepts. And ultimately, you want to ask questions that lead to application. Now, watch me here. Why don't we just turn to the book of Matthew, if you would, for a moment. And let's go to Matthew chapter 9. Verse 35. We'll talk about how this works just briefly. Jesus went through all the towns and villages, I'm reading out of the NIV, teaching in their synagogues, preaching good news of the kingdom, healing every disease and sickness. When he saw the crowds, he had compassion on them because they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, the harvest is plentiful, but the workers are few. Ask the Lord of the harvest, therefore, to send out workers into his harvest field. Go to chapter 10 and verse 1, he called his 12 disciples to him, gave them authority to drive out evil spirits. Verse 5, 12, the 12 Jesus sent out with the following instructions, do not go among the Gentiles, and so on. Now, here's a fact-based question. There's lots of fact-based questions here, but here's one. What are four things that Jesus did here? Four things that Jesus did. Okay. We see here in the beginning, he was teaching in their synagogues. He was preaching the good news. Okay? Now, what are some more things? Let's leave those. There's two things. Now, let's go on. From there on, give me some more things that he did. Okay? He gave power. What else? He healed. Or gave them authority to heal, at least in this particular passage. 9. Okay, I see. You're saying at the end of 35 there. 36 on. What else do we have? Okay. It says he saw. It says he had compassion. So seeing is one thing he did. We have feeling. We have him sending out in the next part, okay? So now what we have here is we have some movement. We have some movement. We see a variety of things happening. We have movements from beginning in 36, he saw, and that is moving to he sent out at the end, right? Okay? So we're observing this. Now what we need to do is begin to ask some other questions. Is there a relationship? In fact, let me just summarize the four things here. First of all, he saw, verse 36. He felt, verse 36. Then it says in verse 37, he talks to the disciples, and he says, we should pray about this. I'm going to suggest that's a third thing he does. Okay? It doesn't record that he actually did it. He says, we need to do it. And then in chapter 10, it says he gives the 12 authority to go out and do what? All kinds of really neat stuff. To minister. So we're observing this. We're down here in the facts. Now, is there a relationship between these things that we saw? He saw, he felt, he prayed, he acted. We want to be, well, no, let's not go there. Is there a relationship between these four things? Is there? What is it? And by the way, you know what I'm feeling up here right now? I see a relationship between those things. And I am just desperately wanting to tell you what that relationship is. But do you see what would happen if I would do that? If I would tell you the relationship? I would abort this process and I'd go right back down here. I would go right down here to facts. I'd just be giving you some more facts. Here's the relationship, folks. Can't do it. I've got to let you. I've asked you a question about facts. Now I'm asking you a question about what's the relationship between these four things that Jesus did?
They're all virtuous.
Okay, they're all virtuous. What else? Okay. Proper activity is needs to be based on good seeing. It's hard to act if you don't see. Good. What else? Okay. These are all parts of that. Okay, good. Oh, and now all of a sudden we're getting on to third level. Were you going
to
say something?
Your soul needs to respond to it.
Okay. So you see, we're starting to form these relationships. And then we can ask a third level question. You want to be a person that God can actually use in mighty ways to heal, to bring healing to people in your world? Are there truths here in this passage that will help us to do that? By the way, what do you see? Is there any concepts here that will help us to apply it in our lives? See anything?
It seems like without prayer, you guys can't respond.
Okay. Needs to be have God's blessing to actually be good activity. Okay? It wasn't some pie-in-the-sky things where he was just dreaming up in his room. These were actual needs that he was working with. That's a good lesson for us, isn't it? Let's go find some needs. But we could spend a lot of time here. We see this is what needs to happen, is that you are forming the connections, not that they're being taught to you. By the way, one other connection here that I really like. Notice it says in verse 36, when he saw the crowds, when you see the crowds, what do you see? Oh, lots of people out there. Is that what he saw? What did he see? Okay, this is a second level question. What did he see? Did he see all the people? What did he see? He saw individuals. And what else? Yeah, how do you know that? Yeah. Now you see, it wouldn't be easy just to look on and just see people. But Jesus saw something completely different. He saw people that were harassed and helpless. So now there's an application for us. We need to learn to see with God's eyes. We need to see beyond the person and see to their heart. Well, let us be sure that in our question asking, we go to all these levels, but we don't give the answers. We shouldn't be too quick to give the answers. It's good. It is good to let people stew for a while on some of the knottier ones. Until they've stewed, they really haven't worked through it. Is that too dangerous? I think it's vital. In fact, what you're going to have happen, see, when you let the students stew, they are going to want you to tell them, where can I go with this? I need some help. But if you give the answer too quick, they won't be hungry for it. They won't be thirsty. They'll write it in their notebooks and then it's gone. But if you wait until you let the process ferment, what is the answer here? Help me. And then you say, well, have you thought about this? Have you thought about this? And what I am so amazed is that you wind up having a class full of people that wind up at a place that's really good. 99 times out of 100. You will get a few people that are they're developed skeptics. And their whole point is to ask the question, and they do not want an answer. And you have to watch out for those. And that's one thing it's going to be easy for you to create with this process. Be aware of it. Because this can be fun. Some people, just the way they're wired, they're going to enjoy asking questions for the sake of asking questions. And that's not what we're about. We're about asking questions because we want to know truth. We need to communicate that. Well, a couple other things here. By the way, there is a book that's available. It's kind of a workbook on how to ask good classroom questions. It's put out by J. Weston Walsh. It's really worth your time going through. I would suggest that in the upper level classroom, most of your time in class should be spent on the question dialectic level. Yes, there's times to be giving information. Depending on the class, you might have to spend a lot of time giving information, but you want to take the time for the issues. That's what the classroom really works. One thing that can really be helpful here, there's a game available called Choices. Have you ever seen it? What it is just a whole bunch of cards that have dilemmas, moral dilemmas on them. Great ways to get students to start interacting with the issues. In fact, one of the things I'll do with these, I'll pick out a bunch of them, pass them around to the students, say, okay, tomorrow you're on, the next day you're on. You have to get up in front of the class and give your dilemma. And then I want the students to vote. They're generally in a yes or no, but you have to defend your answer. I want everybody to vote. And now you give your position, and I want them to try to either confirm it or talk you out of it. We have great times with that. But again, it's getting them thinking on this level. Spend time looking at current events in light of Scripture. How do you teach a person to handle the knowledge that they have and the conclusions that they've come to in ways that are life-giving? How do you teach your students to handle this information in ways that do not cripple them for life? Because lots of people get crippled right here. They gain so much information, and they're so thoughtful, and they can argue you out of any position you have that they think that the answers are in knowledge and in thinking. And right here is where there's a huge disconnect between these two and this one. And it's a danger we run into every day when we teach, is that we are in danger of creating students who are educated fools. They know a lot. They really are intelligent. They can think well, but they have become impressed with their own abilities in those areas. And it becomes the very thing that destroys them. Now, how do we avoid that? This is why I am so convinced that you guys are incredibly important in this whole process. That's why education needs to happen in relationship, not between facts and a person. When God wanted to communicate truth, He did not do it exclusively through propositions, through statements of fact. How did He do it? Through Christ. Through a person. Now, I'm not sure what all is involved in that, but we need to camp out on that for a while. But when we are going to communicate truth in a context that works and is safe and is balanced, it needs to be done in the context of a person. Remember I said I walked into my prof's office? And he really let me have it. You know what I was going in there for? I was going in to tell him that I was dropping out of school to go teach in an individualized school. And when he found out that that's what I was there for, I wanted to talk to him about it, see what he thought. He blistered me up and down, and I wasn't sure where. This is why he blistered me. He said, I believe that every school has the right to have an individualized approach to education if they would like. But he said, true education, biblical education, is always in the context of relationship. Now, the challenge is, if you are in an individualized school, it's okay. You can still do it in the context of relationship. Okay? Don't get me wrong. I'm not against it entirely. But we've got to keep that in there. You see, facts facts and thinking, reason, are very, very dangerous things. And unless we help our students to know how to handle them, we're going to create a bunch of atheists if we're not careful. Have you noticed the university system lately? It just seems that the further you go, the higher the concentration of people that reject revelation as a way of knowing truth. I don't think that's an accident. There is something that is deceptive about knowing. It was, remember, it wasn't just the tree of the knowledge of evil in the garden. It was the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Knowledge, we better deal with this adequately, or we're going to be doing our students a disservice. And again, I would suggest that it's in between here that this break comes. We've seen there's a break between these two. We've talked about how to get over that break. We need to get past this break as well. You don't just teach people how to raise questions and ask questions. We've got to do it somehow in the context so that people can come to answers that lead them to wisdom. How do we do that? What's the methods?
Like sharing the
truth. I think that's key, and that's why I think the relationship is so important. They need to see how someone has worked through, has moved through the grammar and the dialectic, and they've moved on to wisdom. They need to see it modeled. I know of no other way to teach the dialectic but through asking questions. I know of no other way to teach the rhetoric but through modeling. And that's why you and I are so incredibly significant in this whole process. And that is also why, in the words of Plato or perhaps Socrates, it is more important to be than to seem. It's more important to be than to seem. The only way we're going to help our students be wise servants is to really be one ourselves. And if we're not that, if we have not passed through these levels in our own development to a certain extent, and have learned to keep knowledge into its proper context, then we're in danger. We're in danger of passing on something. But we're really in danger of creating something for our students that perhaps would have been better if we wouldn't have gone there. That's why I think God says many of you shouldn't go there. This is scary. Because if I can get in front of class and I can put on airs and I can sing, but unless I really am, the question is, am I going to be able to really, really help people move here? Now, along with the method of modeling, you need to provide opportunities for your students to bring conclusions to what they're studying. And this can be a really exciting part of what you do. What are some of these opportunities? You need to give them opportunities to teach Sunday schools. One of the things we do in our school is that, yeah, the students, before they graduate, they have to teach Sunday school at least once. And it's observed. I generally sat in on it and watch them teach. They hate it, but they talk about it then for years afterwards. But it's a way to get them to try, give them an environment to operate on this level. Teaching Sunday school. We integrate this into our chapels all the time. And so that our high school students, they have to give topics, devotionals, object lessons for a children's meeting, that type of thing. We split our younger groups up into smaller groups, and then the older ones teach them. We're giving them opportunities to teach, to work on that level with the students. Okay? And so another thing would be community service. another way of communicating the types of things that they're working through. Now, along with that, what I said earlier, modeling, it's important that you model not only what it means to be wise, but you model what it means to communicate that. And so if you want them to teach Sunday school, you show them how you put a Sunday school class together. You model it. You do it right up in front of them. You put the on an overhead projector, you put a class together. Object lessons, you put one together, and then you give it. You show how you practice it. You model the entire process, and it is amazing the kinds of stuff you can get out of students if you model it. In fact, that was one of my earlier frustrations in teaching. I'd say, I want y'all to do a speech on such and such, and then they would just fall flat. And I would be so depressed. Until we started doing that thing. We'd work on one together, step by step by step. Here's how you get your introduction, your 3 points, your conclusion, so on. Once we modeled it, they came up with terrific stuff. Okay. Any questions or comments then on methods? Very good question. That's a real naughty one, and I don't have a lot of terribly good answers. Although even there, I think it's worthwhile. I'm generally just a lot more selective in the topics that I would let them take. And so I guess that's one way I would handle that. But maybe you have some thoughts on it. I have, most of the time, I've been very fortunate, and when working with 10 through 12, but now if they're a younger group, junior high, and where the question of whether they've reached significant age or not is still there, then feel free to use them. The problem is if you have someone who's living in rebellion or something like that, where it would really affect their message. That's when there could really be a significant factor. Okay, someone else. Yeah, it's a relationship between someone. Actually, he said it this way: it's a relationship between someone who knows and someone who doesn't. That's where learning needs to take place. It's in the context of the relationship, and it's a relationship between people, not between a person and fact. How do we judge our effectiveness as teachers? When all is said and done, if our students are able to win Bible trivia contests, have we been effective? Well, we would have been on this level. If we create students who are just tremendous debaters, I mean, they can win an argument any day, or they know the issues, and they can give you both sides and so on. Have we accomplished what we want? Well, we would have done well here, if that's the way it is. But no, that's not what we want. James 3, verse 13. Who is wise? Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show it by his good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. Oh, there's so much there. But what we want to see, if we've done our job well in our Bible class, we want them operating, if at all possible, on that level. And the way we'll know it is if they're humble. It's exactly the opposite of what we generally think happens when you educate a person. But that's because we abort the process right here. And if we can go ahead and encourage them to move on through here, it will produce humility. But again, that's why you are so significant in the process, and it's why you must be humble. Because humility is the proper end, the proper result of a well-educated person. Humility. Isn't that strange? How are you going to know if your students are there? If you have humble students. All ones that know a lot. Ones that can articulate the issues well. But ones that understand their own their own humanity. And then it says ones that are doing good deeds. The whole point of this is that we create world changers who are living a lifestyle of service, but in a very humble way. That's our goal. That's how we'll know if we're effective, if our students are that way. Well, I wanted to just mention, too, in closing a little bit, and I'll just really open it up for any other questions that we didn't cover. A couple resources. Here's another one. Nelson's Complete Book of Bible Maps and Charts. Again, great resource for grammar. Two books, though, that I just really, really like. One is called Living by the Book by Howard Hendricks. And the other one is Understanding and Applying the Bible by Robertson McQuilkin. This one is a great introduction to Bible study. Methods. He actually walks you through all three parts of this. First part of his book is on observation, then on application, or then on interpretation and application. But really worthwhile. In fact, we use this as a textbook in our high school there at home. But along with that, this is also the textbook, I believe, that is used at Dallas Theological Seminary in the master's program. In fact, the person who wrote it is one of the teachers in that program. But that's just quality book, can be a good reference book for a course on Bible study. This one here is a little more in-depth, and I'm not sure you would want to use it on a high school level necessarily, but it has to do with how to interpret Scripture. And lots of really good help there. Okay, final quote. The mediocre teacher tells, the good teacher explains, the great teacher demonstrates, the superior teacher inspires. And that's what we want to do in all of this. We want to inspire. Inspire students to go beyond where we are. Okay, that's all I have prepared. Do you have any questions that you'd like for us to work on together? I guess I'm supposed to give y'all a break in here, am I not? If y'all don't have any questions, we can just break, period. But, yes?
Do you have any more to say about the break over from dialectic to rhetoric? You said modeling. You stand up front, you tell them where you were and where you are now.
Yeah, good question. Because I use modeling in two different ways there. One way I use modeling to say you need to show them how you do Sunday school lessons and so on. And that's not what I mean when I say modeling earlier. When I say modeling in the context of bridging this gap, what I mean is not that you actually consciously say anything, but that you have, in your own development, you have bridged that gap somewhat. And so just by the way you live, the way that you talk about truth, the way that you address the issues models that you're here.
So are you saying that those who would eat up the dialectic and would like to stay there, would like to get there before the other people get there and stay there after the other people leave?
Exactly.
Have a kind of a spiritually retarded, so to speak, in their development and are majoring on that kind of thing to excuse their lack of development in other areas, and that you're modeling the humility of mastery points out to them that they really don't have much.
That is ideally the way it would work, yes. That your life calls them to something deeper, something more significant. It is easy to live here once you've learned. In fact, this can be intoxicating. And you've got to push through that. And you need to help your students do it. How? By having worked through at least some of it yourself. And then, yes, being open to that struggle. I think that is it. Just talking about some of the ways that you worked through and the way some of the lights came on for you. See, it is much easier to tear down a system than it is to build up one. Much easier. And you will find students. Well, one of my nephews was like this. He was just brilliant in being able to, anything you said, he could find the holes in. And I just had to encourage him, okay, yeah, you're wanting to be a skeptic, because you don't think there's any answers, I want to challenge you. Try to find someone yourself, for yourself. And he did. He took the challenge. But it's easy to just want to live right there. It's much easier than pushing through. You all heard the question. I'd like some general input on that. How do you deal with a skeptic in your classroom? And maybe I would add to that, how do you not deal with them?
Don't let them scare you.
Exactly. But how do you do that? What if you are scared? See, there's the problem here. What if you run into somebody with a greater intellect than yours? Frankly, some years ago, I picked up a book from a library, and it was on proofs of Christianity, except it was taken the other side. I started reading it, and I was shook. And I put it down after about two chapters because I realized this guy was able to play with my mind in ways that I couldn't deal with. Now, just because someone has the ability to do that does not make them right. Okay? But anyway, so I recognized that I wasn't quite ready for that. I never did go back to it. And maybe I'm still not ready for it. But you see, if you operate on that level, the person who has the most brilliant mind can become out the winner. You've got to communicate that that's not the basis. It's not the best debater that is right, necessarily. So that's one thing you're going to need to communicate. Hey, look, you're bringing some good questions up. But now we've got to find answers. Can you help us find answers to that? So one way to handle it is to throw the ball back in their court. You know, boy, those are great questions. Yes! Boy, now we're getting somewhere. What are the answers? Yeah. Oh, yeah, see, the thing you don't do is you don't say, you shouldn't be asking something.
I have a question on the skeptic. You're talking about
We can have skeptical believers. In other words, their belief system is still not based on thoughtfulness. It's based more on tradition. Their skepticism is operating in a different sphere. But given enough time, that skepticism will take over all their life. And so, yes, you can have skeptical believers. It's just they haven't been willing to apply their skepticism there yet. But let me tell you, when they get to be 25 and life is going rough, they're gone. And that's why if we can help to work through that skepticism in a positive way. But you always, always, always insisting people to start coming to some conclusions. I think it can be very helpful. Once again, you're modeling the fact that you've gone to that third stage. Yeah, I think there is. It's a great question. Let me just see if we can finish up here once. Does that get to where you're going, or do you have something else you want to say? I think you acknowledge that, yes. Boy, man, that is a terrific question.
Tell you what, I'm not sure what we do with that one. That's what I didn't think about. See what this is worth thinking about. I'm going to do that. And I want you to do it. And let's get back together tomorrow. We'll pick that up again.
Tell you what, we got a problem, class. We got a question we don't know the answer for. What are the ways we're going to find answers to our question? Then you can need something else. Ways of knowing. You know, what would be? You can talk to your parents. Hey, that's a good way to know it. What else could we do to find out an answer to that? And then you begin to say, hey, you know, we really need something absolute. We need some kind of absolute basis for an answer to that. You can start building in some appreciation for authority. Do you have any other comments on your question before we move on?
I thought you. Okay. Once you move on to that stage of learning, suddenly you're process, it can be very easy to make that skeptic think that skepticism is the end for what he's doing, if you handle him improperly. If he is able to get your goat, he's going to think that that is an end in itself.
There's a discussion that the skeptics in the church this morning have perfectly got it on. And they said, well, is it ever right to rebuke a skeptic? And that's for one thing. A skeptic, you can appeal to them on the basis of what Christ would do. They tend to make un-Christ-like statements at every turn. And I've already had a conversation with people where I just thought what I thought shattered, challenged, where I didn't even work. We didn't have any conclusions, but and I let them know that's the way I felt. But then it's like you said, as life goes on, the ball goes back into their own court. And you know, for instance, I had a pretty good discussion with someone that he didn't believe about. There's any way to determine the will of God. I mean, it's just you make your choices and then what happens happens. And you know, you allow enough time to go by. And it's good for yourself because makes you search what you believe, and it also makes the things clear to him that it wasn't before, which he's open to see because you didn't know. You didn't allow him to. It's in the basis you can rebuke someone like that, or even work with them because you both do believe in Christ and what Christ would do, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have any experience with students being skeptics, but the people in the church.
Skeptics can really get irritating in the classroom, but you must learn to appreciate them, because I have had classes where there are no skeptics, and it is like pulling teeth to get down on this level. You ask questions and you ask questions and you ask questions, and everybody just sits there. It's too much work. If you got a skeptic or two in the class, well, they'll liven it up in a hurry. And so that can be a positive side. But if you let them irritate you, you've lost the battle. Now, do you ever rebuke? It seems like almost too harsh of a word to me. I think what you want to do is encourage a skeptic. Well, you have some great questions. I bet you could come up with even better answers. Get them going there.
Well, kind of along with that, sometimes you have to kind of leave an issue, especially if the facts are not knowledgeable.
Yeah.
Like, I ran into that when we had clients close to me across the state of dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I kind of Right. decided to fight getting students to think it's possible that there are still dinosaurs living today in the jungles of Africa where there's, you know, no man has ever been, or is it possible that there's still dinosaurs living in some of these ocean parts where no person has ever explored. To get them thinking, this is a new doctor, some of the students. And so they were, we had spent, you know, several days looking at the science textbook. We had all this evidence, you know, we had looked at scripture passages, we had looked at all these.
By the way, what science textbook? Okay.
And so, I didn't know.
Yeah, oh, tremendous. You're going to come up sometimes where your dialectic takes you places that are not comfortable. And that in itself gives you an opportunity to talk about that, because that's where we all live. In our churches, sometimes as I said in scriptures, I come to different conclusions than what the church does. What do I do with that? Now, if you're working on the elementary grades, in the upper grades, you can start walking through that. What is the proper way? What is the proper way? You're never going to get a good answer here, but you're going to get a great answer down here. The end is not this truth that I have. I don't have to major on that. What I do have to major on is a life of service lived out in humility. And all of a sudden, I can start holding some ideas and still submit myself to a group. I can still value my parents who have some ideas that I know aren't right. It's okay. Because I know that I'm not right in everything either.
You see, when you start getting on that level, you begin to see knowledge and your own limitations in regards to that knowledge. And you realize that, you know, I'm never going to know everything, and the things that I think I know aren't going to always be right. And so therefore, I don't need to be so dogmatic about stuff. Doesn't mean I don't try to think through them. I don't try to come to answers. But I still have an appreciation for your perspective. And value that. And value you as a person, despite the fact that we disagree. Well, I don't know how practical some of this has been, but anyone else? Okay. Thank you for your input. It seemed like there was one other thing we were talking about that I really wanted to say one thing about yet, but it had to do with... Anyway, y'all have a good rest of the evening.
For the most current Faith Builders recordings, visit christianlearning.org. And for more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit the docforlearning.org.